Hey, what's going on, guys? And welcome to another interview on the Brian Kenny podcast. In this episode, I sit down with none other than Owen Barra. Owen most recently founded More Irish Gin. More Irish Gin is a handcrafted wildberry gin that has been exported across 15 different countries, which is pretty huge. Before More Irish Gin, Owen founded a design agency here in Dublin, which is named V7, and that was created in 2011. And that grew then into having offices in Switzerland and the UK and the Netherlands. And the client portfolio included companies such as Aer Lingus and Vodafone and Intel and even Goldman Sachs. It was pretty huge. Owen is a seasoned entrepreneur, and it's an absolute honor to have him on the podcast. So sit back, get comfortable, and enjoy the show. Okay, so I am here with the awesome, the wonderful Owen Barra. And as I do at the beginning of all of the podcasts, is I let the guest introduce themselves for fear of me butchering it and getting it completely wrong.
Oh dear, I wasn't expecting that. Thanks, Brian.
Straight in there.
So I'm Owen Barra. I am a drinks and design entrepreneur, I guess. Although I don't really like the term entrepreneur. I just think it's a little bit meh.
I do
interesting things with design and drinks.
Awesome. So what I tend to do at the very beginning is to talk about where it all began. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Tullamore.
So Tullamore.
County Offaly, you know, the land of bog and dreams.
And did you do farmer related things?
Oh, well, I footed turf every year, as yes. Is customary child labor in Offaly. Yeah.
Because my dad is from Mayo, which is the very west of Ireland, and there was always chats and kind of slaggings through the whole family of, you have to go and cut turf at some point in your life. I never actually did it, but I've heard about the sweat and tears and...
It's backbreaking labor, and you're literally doubled over, and you don't really know. So you know the way you go to the gym, you get this kind of like... the aching pain after the gym.
Yeah,
nothing compared to footing turf.
So you went to school obviously in Tullamore.
Yeah.
And where did that lead to? At what point did you decide it's time to go to the big city,
the big schmoke? So I think I was 17 leaving school, and I was like, hey, I'm going to become a doctor. I didn't get the points to become a doctor. Yeah, I'd be the worst doctor ever. Like Nick Riviera from The Simpsons, they wouldn't have a patch on me. I'm the shortest attention span. It would just be, I'd be terrible. It would be a medical mishap.
But it was a dream of yours when you were young to become a doctor?
Yeah, I think I wanted to help people. I think I was kind of interested in how the body worked. I was really interested in biology. And I was like, oh, there's so much to learn and so interesting. And then I didn't get the points for it. So I decided that I'd take a year out. And all through, like, from 12 until, I don't know, now, like, I was just making stuff on the internet. So I was making this comic called PaddyandSeamus.com, which was about two alcoholic leprechauns that I'd animated in Flash. I know, it was nuts. And like drawing it on acetate, scanning it, coloring it in Flash. Like, it was just like, I don't know how I had so much free time as a child.
Yeah.
To do that. But anyways, I did all that all the way up. And then around 17, I was like, well, I better go get a job and save some money for college and figure out what I want to do. So I got a job in a petrol station. That lasted about 3 weeks until I quit. And I joined a web design studio. Which got on really well, did some really cool stuff. And the guy asked me to become a partner in it. And I think I had my sights set on Dublin. So I was like, right, I'm going to Dublin.
So to go back, the Flash and the comic and the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the computer come from? Did your parents have one in the household? Or?
So my parents bought one when I was about, I'd say, 11 or 12. My brother had convinced them that IT is the future. You need to, like, get
computers are going to be a thing.
Yeah. And there we go. It was like an Intel Celeron with 400 megahertz. I think my phone has more power than what we started off with.
you know, Snapdragons are kicking ass now. Mm. But it's amazing because I remember clear as day the first computer that we had in the house, and when Dad went and brought it home, and myself and my brother having a kind of a similar experience of just going, wow, like there's so much that we can do with this, and like computer games and all of that. But it was back at a time where it was like QBasic and all of these really low level programming languages and stuff were around, and you're trying to figure out how to make it just print something on the screen.
I remember like reading books on C++ and like being like, okay, this is a compiler, and like reading all these things and being like, I have no idea what this means, but I'll give it a go.
But you see, that's it. That's the thing that it seems to be like a recurring theme in this podcast and every person that I've had on so far, is that the actual discovery or unlocking of a new skill or being able to create or to build something, it seems to be more often than not self-taught by the person, you know, mm-hmm. that you found a book or you didn't get the points to do it, what the plan was at the time, but then you unlock this whole other chapter of your life where you're like, that thing allows me to go and to make things. I should learn more about that.
Yeah. And for me, like learning HTML and learning how to design and kind of getting more and more into that, kind of learning the principles behind the visceral design, behavioral design, you kind of go, wow, this is fascinating. And like people respond to this, they respond to this color, they respond to this shape. You know, you kind of go, wow, that's incredible. I have the ability to touch so many people's lives all at once.
Yeah.
And but then it was like, well, I can also program this stuff. I can also make this stuff happen on screen, and this goes into a database. I remember the first time getting something to go into a database. I was like, oh my.
What is this wizardry?
I read a book called PHP in 24 Hours, and that title is incredibly misleading. It took me like 4 months, right? So I was like, okay, I've got the basic mastery of PHP. And then I was like, okay, now what do I do? Well, I'll build a listing website for people to put their businesses up on. Like, so. And I remember like trying to hack it together, and it worked. And I was like, oh my God, this worked. And then I quickly lost interest in that.
Because it was done?
I think so. Or because I didn't see how I was going to commercialize it. So this was like back when the internet was the Wild West. I remember looking into, one thing I really hated was paying for parking with coins, because I'd never have coins on me. I was like, it must be able to do this with a text message. And there was legislation at the time that said that you couldn't pay for a physical thing by the phone. And I was like, well, this makes no sense. And I remember like just being like, well, that's that dead in the water. What do I do now? And I was like, moved on to something else.
But that's pretty crazy, though, that, you know, when we really think about it, the first step for you is that, okay, the computer's allows me to go and to create something. And so you created the something. Mm. And then the next step for you was into the commercialization of like, how do I actually build this into a product where people will react and give me money and do things where I can make it a
yeah, further. Yeah, it was like, I'd like to do this all the time. I wish people would pay me to do this, you know? So I remember like at the time, there was the whole thing. It was like, okay, well, no, software jobs won't exist because it's just going to be outsourced to India. And, you know, there's so many people there. And I was like, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't do, like, shouldn't do software. So I went and I did a network engineering course. So I did like a CCNA, which is Cisco Certified Network Associate. And that was kind of like the fundamentals of computers. So you kind of go, okay, well, I know everything from subnets to IPs to like being able to count in hex and count in binary. And I was like, oh, this
always is useful.
Oh, completely. Every day I use it
when you're trapped in the space station or something.
So there was like things like that, did a like that sort of course, and I was like, oh yeah, well great, and well, we're gonna become a network engineer. And there was no jobs in network engineering in Ireland, so I was like, right, back to the drawing board.
But so after the 3 weeks in the petrol station,
yeah,
and then you found a dev house or company that were starting to build some things, and you went over there next?
So I went there. That was all really good. I had a really good time with those guys, built some really interesting things, decided I was moving to Dublin.
You were working remotely for them at the time?
No, this is in Tullamore.
Ah, okay.
And then I went to Dublin. I had an accident where I bruised my brain, so I had to move home. And I developed a stutter, and I used to walk into door frames because I like completely lost my my depth perception. So I didn't know how wide I was. I didn't know how far away the door was.
That's crazy. And
I wouldn't be able to think of words for like whatever the table was. I'd be like, oh yeah, it's over there on the, and I would just draw a complete blank. So that took a good 6 months to kind of get over. So when you hear people talk about concussion injuries and things like that in rugby, it's incredibly serious.
Yeah.
And mine was just caused from like a pretty bad fall onto a tile floor. So that was incredibly terrifying.
That's insane. Wow.
So then I kind of set up another company. Set up a company doing design work. So I was like, I'm going to do this by myself. And that was mildly successful, but like you're a one-man band. I eventually just got bored of that.
And why the plummet from one agency to the other to go and create your own, to have the autonomy yourself? Or
yeah, I was just like, well, look, we're kind of doing this wrong. Like, as in, we're kind of taking like a lot of shortcuts. I don't really like this. We can do better. You know, if we did this, this, and this, we could do. And it just, you're trying to change someone else's mind, the guy who owns the business. I was like, right, fine, I'm just going to do it myself. And like people were coming to me being like, oh, can you build me a website? And I was like, sure, you know. So I built loads. So it was all fine. Decided to do that, set it up. Did it for about a year and a half or something. I just got bored of it then. And I was just like, I just didn't really like it. The problem was I couldn't grow wood past just me. And that becomes a perpetuating cycle. You're like, you know, money in, you do some work, and then you got to go search for the money again, and then you got to do the work.
Exactly.
So it became this like really like unfriendly cycle, I guess.
Yeah. And so when you made the conclusion that, you know what, I'm going to go and try and do this myself or set up my own shop, you had some customers already ready to go who were kind of already bought in and bought into you and the service that you can provide.
Yeah. And yeah, like knowing what I know now versus knowing what I knew then, like it's just like, oh, that was so amateurish. Like in fairness, it was better than what a lot of people were providing at the time. And that was kind of something that I really prided myself on.
And it started to grow further and further to a point that it was time to get somebody else, or?
No, it was getting to, like, it was this self-perpetuating cycle where I'd be, like, getting work and not, and doing it, getting work and doing it, rather than kind of getting work and building a pipeline or kind of getting bigger jobs. It was just kind of all around the same size. And I kind of had, I'm better than this. I had this kind of, like, want for more. So I decided that I was going to move country, and I was gonna like join an agency in the Nordics so what happened was I ended up like working for this company in the UK who had pimped me out to a company in the Nordics, and I got paid incredibly handsomely for the age I was. Now I know you can see me, like, as in, I've got a big beard. I've always had, like, stubble, and I've always looked much older, right? So I think I was maybe, like, 21, 22 or something at the time.
Yeah.
And people would ask me, they were like, so I was getting paid this, like, senior designer wage, and they're like, so how old are you? And my standard answer was just, without even thinking, it was 28. It was like, 28.
Off the cuff, going into, like, a bar, a bouncer's asking you your age, 28.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, I was 28 for 4 years.
That's crazy. What country, or was it all countries in the Nordic region?
So it was mainly Finland. So based out of Helsinki, and then you're flying back to London, and essentially just the travel got far too much.
Helsinki's a great city. Oh,
it's unbelievable. I would go back in an instant.
Saunas everywhere.
I know. And it's just like Helsinki, like Stockholm, and I haven't been to Norway yet, but it's on the list. So then I came back to Ireland on kind of a whim, and I was getting back with a girlfriend that I went out with, and we'd been in contact for a few months, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna move home.
You moved back home for a girl?
every cliche. And you know the advice where it's like, just don't do it. So that lasted, I think, what happened then? Yeah, I took a job with RTE. So I was like, I came back, I had no job. I took a job with RTE and they paid me 18 grand on a contract role, mind you. Like, as in, I didn't even get paid, like, my taxes.
$18,000 for what period of time?
For 6 months.
Ouch.
So, yeah, so I got paid $9,500. It was so bad that I don't think I could afford to live in Dublin. And this is like, I think this is 2008 or 2009. It was like, they had the public sector pay freeze.
I remember.
It was all nuts. So that job lasted longer than that relationship.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting. And then I kind of took a couple of other jobs here and there, like just doing web and stuff. But then I set up an agency called V7. With a guy called Alan Geeran, and we had the idea of doing design and development, and that kind of that worked out for like 5 years.
That was a really big agency here, though. Like, that was
some
stellar work.
We did some really good stuff. We had some really good clients, but at the end of it, it was just you lose the passion for it. The client.
Tell me more about that. That's something that I'm really intrigued by. Obviously, with myself owning a product agency here as well, we're now on year three of it, and I'm eager to hear more.
Year three was a great year for us. Year one and year three were awesome, and it gets to a point where it becomes, unless you grow beyond where you are, just knocked over a cup there. So unless you get beyond the sort of 5-man to 8-man agency, and until you can put in structure and you can actually, like, for me it was like, I want to do more strategy, I want to do bigger jobs, we wanted to be like just kind of the main contractor on a lot of big bills, whereas like we were getting drafted in by other agencies to do their UX work because they just scored this like €1 million contract, and
sure,
we need you guys to do the online stuff, and you're like, ah, we'd like to do more of that stuff. So it was kind of a weird thing. It was like, either we changed our focus, which was like we were a UX house that did development. If we changed our focus to becoming a brand house or becoming sort of a full service agency. But that really wasn't what we were. We were more digital first and then roll that out towards everything else.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because in the last 2 or 3 years, or the last 2 years, I think it's kind of changed. It's kind of shifted more towards digital first. So we were just kind of a little bit ahead of the time. But also, you know, we could have done better things. Like, we made a lot of mistakes. We made so many mistakes. It's ridiculous.
But it's, I mean, the main pain points that we're going through in MiniCorp right now are around cross-pollination of learnings through the team is a very difficult one. So let's say Steve is working away on a problem that's an engineering problem and overcomes the challenge and kind of commits the code and ships it and off the product goes. It's how Fatima or myself or anybody I met, any other member of the team then understands that Steve went through that, and to kind of find the shortest path if I was to ever find that problem myself. It's a really difficult one. But I think as an agency grows, I've definitely become more aware that it's computers were always a tool that allowed me to build things, but now it's more people. People are the thing that allows me to build things.
So we had something called a bus factor. So it was like, how many people could get hit by a bus and could the company still run? So, and that was kind of
that's a pretty good thing.
Yeah, so we kind of used it as an analogy for...
Not that I want people to get hit by a bus, but...
Well, it was an analogy for people quitting, you know, churn, just things like that.
Yeah.
So, as in, what sort of knowledge did it take with them? So we didn't want to have this tribal knowledge, but also we didn't want to document it. So what we would do is we would have a weekly meeting, which generally involved some beers and some nachos. And we'd be like, okay, what was the biggest challenge this week? And it was like, it was kind of good because people would be like, you come in, you go, okay, doesn't matter if I was your problem, let me know.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of this sort of over beers being like, okay, Owen, you're an absolute idiot. You said that you could do this in 3 days, and then it all fell on me to do this in 3 days. It's like, my bad, okay, estimation was wrong. You know,
yeah.
But some constructive criticism, like you're letting all of your stuff out on the table and then figuring out the best paths forward from there.
Yeah, and generally what we do is one-on-ones with the team once a week. So I would go for lunch with one of the guys once a week and be like, hey, what's going on? Like, are you getting on with Steve or Sean or Connor? Like, what's going on? And you just kind of have this one-on-one meeting. And you'd find out really interesting things like team sentiment. So we'd be like, sometimes it was just like people were getting really fed up of the pace we were working at. So
too fast or too slow?
Too fast. So oftentimes that, like, there'd be times where we'd do things incredibly fast and then there would be this famine of work. And it was like, it was always around the same time of year. It was always like August. But like, it was really weird because one year we had this incredible August where we were just flat out and we were like, this is incredible. And then we had nothing in September. And we're like, well, that's kind of weird. And then it was always busy in December and January. January was like people are just kicking off projects. It was always insane.
Yeah.
So it was always just this kind of weird seasonality of the work.
Do you think that is... The majority of that concern is from the fact that it's in Ireland, or were these international clients?
So we grew to the point where we had an office in Zurich in Switzerland, and then we had an office in Amsterdam, and we had another development office in Bucharest.
Wow.
We had Dublin, and we were just going into the UK. So we kind of had like a company structure where it was a partnership between ourselves and another company.
And you could distribute the work amongst the whole network.
Exactly, yeah. So in Dublin, we focused on UX and design. In Switzerland and in Bucharest, they focused on development.
So right.
That was quite interesting.
How did you originate that whole network? Did you know people that were in these different cities, and that's where, if we joined forces and created this whole big thing, this could be deadly?
So I met this guy called Marcus from Switzerland, I think back in 2012, 2013. And I knew him through some mutual friends and stuff like that. And we were going up to Donegal on a surf trip.
Nice.
So I ended up with like four random guys in my car. And Marcus was the guy in the front seat who brought the slab of cans. And immediately I knew, like, me and Marcus are going to be friends.
Hey, Marcus.
So, like, we're driving up, and, like, he was working on a startup at the time that basically synced all your contacts across some networks. He'd raised some investment, and he was very much a product guy. And then he ended up working for the equivalent of, what are those token sites called? You know, the vouchers you get, like... Living Social, like one of them.
Yeah, and then the bigger one, Groupon?
Groupon, yes, okay. So he ends up working for the Swiss equivalent of Groupon. And then left that, and he was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I was like, you should just set up a product studio, because that's what you're really passionate about. And he was like, yeah. He's like, I think I have... Because he was a product manager... So I think I've got the skills for that, and we kind of worked it out. So we came up with the branding, so Viable, so V7 and Viable, both V names, we did all the stuff.
Nice.
And we kind of launched it. And then Marcus became unbelievable. He brought in some amazing clients. We had like some huge Swiss companies like meet us. And it was really, really interesting because Marcus had like a two-person office, but it was, I think, 100 square meters. Beautiful, like in this warehouse. So they would come in and there would be like two desks and a meeting table. And they'd be like, oh, where's the... I was like, well,
the team?
The lads are in Bucharest.
Like. Yeah. And was it faced with aversion from the clients then when they seen that the team wasn't necessarily there?
No, so like absolutely not, like, because it was quality guaranteed, like it was Swiss quality. And then the Irish design as well. So they were like, the design's really good, and like, well, we use specialists in each area. So it's like, it's not that, they're going, well, if you're paying this in Switzerland, you would be looking at 10 times more. Whereas like these guys are an hour on a flight and they're really, really good at what they do.
Yeah. It's probably one of the main reasons of why we've moved here to WeWork. Mm. It allows us to kind of grow out our distribution network and go on a little bit of a business development hunt over the next year. So in July, we're going to go to New York and hang there for a week and try to get as many back-to-back meetings as possible. but it'll also allow the other side of it. So the majority of people who tend to want to come and work in MiniCorp will want to, you know, move and travel and do all these things. So the, by fact of being in WeWork, they can say, hey, I'm going to take 3 months and I'm going to go to Stockholm.
Oh, sorry.
You're okay. And then, you know, that it allows that flexibility where a designer, a developer, or any member within the team can kind of move and ebb and flow and so on, which is pretty handy.
Yeah, it allows you to dip in and out.
Yeah.
Have a base in every city, really.
But it's, I don't think I've ever faced aversion from clients who go, oh, there's only X amount of you here, or where's the rest of the team, or anything like that. As long as there's a good, plausible reason why you, or how you create the level of standard of work that you do, it's met with just, you know, happiness and ready to roll.
Yeah, we had that a couple of times from big clients where they were like, you're going to need at least 20 people on this. And we're like, do we? Because it's like, we've kind of estimated, and it's like, it's going to take us this amount of time, but we're not stacking your work like side by side with anyone else. We're just focusing purely on this. And some, like anyone who had worked with like creative agencies, like print agencies, they were used to these like incredibly long deadlines. And they were like, but they have 20 people. How are you able to do it? And it's like, because we're only doing your project.
And they love that. They our clients love it mainly because the fact that the entire diversity of the product team will be working on their product.
Yeah.
And they love that. It's and so at what point then did things start to kind of taper off in V7, or you made the conscious decision that it's time for the next thing?
So I think maybe 2015, we started to see like a downturn. We were like kind of going, okay, there's not as much work as there was. And what we saw was some of the bigger agencies, like the likes of WPP groups or Havas, right, them, who were traditionally print and design, they were starting to move into UX and digital. And it was really interesting because what they were doing is they were taking in the work, but they were just contracting it out to smaller agencies that were UX specialists. So we were like, okay, this is terrible. Or even worse, they were trying to do it themselves. And that was like, oh, this is like the worst combination, because now people think that this is good UX because these people do amazing graphic work. So there was that, and we started looking around. We were like, okay, well, what are we going to do? Will we build a product? And we kind of thought about a couple of things. So one of the things that we thought about was like kind of an eatery sort of web page, like, because often the times, like, restaurant pages were awful. Like, you're like, this restaurant is terrible. I'd much prefer if there was like a listing. I could just see everything in a standardized format, see the food, almost like, you know, TripAdvisor,
yeah,
for food. So we're like, okay, well, how are we going to make money? It's like, we don't know. So there was these things. We're like, so how can we commercialize ideas? And I remember back in 2012, we had the idea for something called DabbaCab, which is like you press a button on your phone and a cab comes to you. Shortly after that, Halo launched.
Yeah. I was just thinking in the back of my head, it's like, what?
So that was interesting. But yeah, so like product ideas were always kind of going through. But what happened in early 2015 was I got really drunk one night. And a friend of mine goes, do you do what you love, Owen? I was like, no, not really. Like,
do you do what?
Do you do what you love?
Oh.
And I was like, I don't really love what I do anymore.
But you did.
I did. I definitely loved it for a long time. And it's kind of funny. Now when I've had some time away, and I come back to it and I'm like, I really enjoy this. I think I was just at the point where I was exhausted. I was just burnt out. I was running an agency.
Makes sense.
And you're on this like roller coaster of highs and lows. And the question was, well, what do you love? And I was like, I love gin. I fucking love gin. Those are the exact words.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, sure, how hard can it be to make gin? And it turns out it's...
What year was this?
2015.
Okay.
And it turns out it's way more difficult than you'd ever expect. So yeah, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to make gin. So I started looking into it, started looking into like the processes.
But hold on, so the guy that was asking you this question already had a gin company or was thinking of starting one, or he was just asking the question?
Just asking the question, because we were talking about how we hated working 9 to 5 or sometimes 9 till 10. And then you'd be like, well, you know, there must be a better way to make money. And there must be a way to do something you enjoy. Like, you see all these people talking about how they found their passion and their vocation and their, like,
what they're calling.
Their calling, yes. Well, except I really liked alcohol.
So where did you start?
So I started on the internet. I was like, okay, well, what was it? How do you make gin, right? So I was like, I knew what gin was made of. I read some books about it. I was like, great. So I was like, okay, you need a still. So how do you go about doing XYZ? So then I flew down to South Africa, which seemed like a little bit, now in hindsight, there's probably places I could have gone that were closer. But at the time, the whole craft distilling thing hadn't kicked off. And this was the only place that I could find that was doing a craft distilling course. So I flew down to South Africa, did the craft distilling course. Then came back, bought a still down there and bought a bottling machine. Flew back to Ireland, went down to the lads in Blackwater, did like one of their demo days. They were like demonstrating like, this is how you set up a gin company. But they are actually very friendly. They were like, here's the place to buy bottles, here's the place to buy caps, here's the place to buy XYZ. Because they were like, look, there's going to be people entering the market. We might as well be friends with them.
And so just to take a few steps back, you fly down to South Africa and you're like, okay, I want to figure out how to make gin professionally or how they're doing it. You go through the course and you walk out with a bottling machine and a still.
Yeah, I flew that up to Ireland. And
on then, Ryanair.
On a KLM, actually.
But they're probably like really expensive pieces of kit, no?
Yeah, and because of the currency differences between the South African rand and the euro, it worked out incredibly in my favor.
But you were committed. Like, you were saying, okay, this is going to be a thing.
Did I ever tell you about the time I bought 100 kilos of coffee when I was drunk?
No.
I decided that one night I was going to make a coffee. I was like, I was going to have a coffee startup and I was going to do this. So I got drunk and bought 100 kilos of coffee online. And about, I'd say about 6 or 8 weeks later, a pallet showed up outside our office.
And you had no recollection of ordering it?
I had no, like, I remember seeing the confirmation and being like, that's weird. And just thinking nothing of it. And then this like green coffee shows up and I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do with this much coffee?
That's weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, like, my God.
The lesson here, Brian, is don't drink to excess.
Okay, so you come back from South Africa, you've got your new mini gin plant,
yeah,
and you head down to Blackwater, meet with some more people, figure out what's involved, get as much advice as you possibly can, and then?
I flew to Germany. I flew to Germany to see how the Germans did it, and then I flew to Scotland and saw how the Scots were making whiskey and how they were making gin, and then I went to Australia. And it was really weird because all the stuff in the southern hemisphere I found as huge inspiration because these guys are so far away from the places where juniper grows like in really good quantities because juniper needs kind of like acidic soil and kind of a little bit of sunlight. Like, so it grows really well like in places like Italy, but it also grows equally as well in places like Iceland and Ireland. But the flavor profile is different.
Okay.
So it's a... So the guys down in Australia were doing incredible things because they had all these plants that we'd never seen. So like in South Africa, they're using rooibos, so like this tea. And they were using plants that only grow on the Cape. And in Australia, they were like, well, we're using like mad stuff. You're like, oh, is that a kangaroo?
Is that a roo?
Yeah, so it was like, okay, well, these guys have this invention, like this sense of invention and sense of adventure from what they're doing. So I came back to Ireland and I was like, well, what am I going to call this? I was like, I don't know. And it was kind of like thinking about Tullamore, and the distillery is named Ardaron after the mountain, the tallest mountain in the Slieve Blooms where the water comes from. And I was like, what am I going to call this? Like, I was going to call it the Blessed Lady Gin. And then I was like, that's a bit
religious.
I think the priest might be onto me about this. Yeah. You know, say like holy water. No. And then there was like, Genevieve Bloom was another name that we were going to call it. And then it was like, well, Genevieve's a style of gin. And then it was like, well, what about Juniper Bloom? And I was like, well, it's too close to this other brand called Bloom. So there was all these like brand exercises that we had to go through, and we had to think about it. But the inspiration really came from, you know, like, what's Tullamore about? And the whole label is based around Tullamore. So I don't know if you've seen our label, the spiral.
I have.
So basically, it's the spiral from one side of the bottle to the other, which is the canal from Dublin to Galway.
Wow, I never knew that.
And then when you like look on the inside of the bottle, there's a print of all these florals, which is like the floral taste of Ireland. And like what's important is in the middle, which is Tullamore. And if you look at our barcode, it's dead center in the middle of the label, and it's actually the mountains.
That's amazing.
So there's all these like little small design details. The other thing is that the canal was used as a postal route. So there's all these like postal marks in the background of our label. There's all these like small nods to Tullamore in it. But like my childhood was based growing up in Tullamore. My parents threatening to leave me in the mountains because I was bold.
But it's amazing to see the you know, everything about your design characteristics kind of flow through to this new physical product.
Let me tell you, so I spent 6 months picking out corks. And it was basically, we have a 21.5 mil opening and our cork is 22.8. Now, the cork company wanted us to use a 23 mil cork. I was
How dare they?
How dare they? But it was like, I didn't like the feeling of it opening. I didn't like how hard it was to open.
And how it pops. And
So the whole experience of opening the bottle and also closing the bottle. Like, so I wanted that to be as fluid as possible, but also keep the liquid in the bottle. And it added cost. It added cost for that detail.
But to knock the 0.2 mil off?
To knock the 0.2 mil off, because it's not a standard size. So it was custom.
You probably have to get, like blanks and done up and all of these other,
So, and then after that it was, so we used these corks, so we got our logo printed on the top of the corks. They're now laser engraved, which is pretty cool.
But talk to me more about, so when you, after Blackwater in the journey of the timeline, and you've decided, you know, I've got this amazing name, I'm ready to roll. How do you get to where you are right now?
So that was all kind of like the first 6 months, right? As in, by I think June 2015, we're pretty much ready to roll. The only thing that we're missing was the legal compliance and a place to distill. So in Tullamore, it was very difficult to get an industrial unit that fitted the requirements by revenue. So that took almost another 7 months to find the right place. Went through three units. One landlord ended up kicking us out because he didn't like what we were doing. And it was all a bit nuts.
Wow.
So then in January 2016, we got our current building. And the first, it was filled with like rubbish. There was like a car that was like T-boned in it, and it was like, oh, I don't even want to ask why that's here. It needs to be cleared out. So we're like sweeping the place out.
It was like a Childish Gambino latest video.
Yeah, it was a little bit like, this is, I don't know what's happened. So from there it was like, okay, we set out, we're like, where are we gonna put the still? Like, we have to do all the plumbing and things like that. But first things first was paint the floor. So painting the floor is very cathartic. So you're like rolling this gray paint on. It was beautiful. So it's like, great.
It feels good.
Yeah, until you realize you've painted yourself into a corner. that didn't happen, by the way. I knew to open the doors. So.
But and then so let's say the manufacturing kicks off and you're rolling your bottles.
So
where's it going?
So essentially, it took us 6 months to get the unit up to spec, right? So it comes down to June. Oh, we've been moved over.
Yeah.
So it took us 6 months to get the manufacturing unit up to spec, right? Then from there, what happened was we moved. It took us another 6 months to get all the bank bond legal and all that sort of stuff. So from that, we had to move on there from, took us till November 2016 to launch, to finally have our first bottle out on the market.
Wow. It's insane.
It's incredible.
It's crazy to recap and to think about where you started and what the journey was to where you are now.
Hmm.
If you had to summarize and to talk to, let's say, your then 18 or 19 year old self, what would be the one kind of, you know, really standout moment that you would say you have to remember this, or this is something that will happen?
I always think that there's this thing called optimism bias, right? And I think every entrepreneur has it. I think it's this childish naivety where you're like, hey, this is all going to work out. This is going to be great. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. But it's actually a lot of the bad things that you don't think are going to happen will happen. So always prepare for the downside. And that's something that has caught me at loads of times. Like, I haven't been prepared for the downside.
Okay.
So yeah, always be prepared, I guess, is scouts on earth.
I know, whatever good things happen is even a benefit.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Okay, so where can people go and say hello to you?
We are at Taste of Dublin this week. So where else are we? We were at Taste of Donabate or Taste of Fingal.
Cool. Any Twitter, Instagram?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. At More Irish Gin. So moreirishgin.com. So at More Irish Gin, and Twitter, Instagram, Facebook are all the same.
Cool. And I will leave links to all of these wonderful different social media accounts in the description of the podcast as well. Okay, a huge thank you to Owen for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And go and follow him and go and drink lots of his gin.
Drink more gin, eh?
Drink more gin. Okay, thanks a million.
Cheers, bro.